Welcome back to Shannon. There are reasons to be frustrated at the President of the United States line about declaring war on the Islamic State, saying that they're not Islamic, saying that they're not a state, saying that we would not engage militarily in on the ground in Syria. We would not engage with boots on the ground in Iraq, and then sending U.S. troops into a raid into Syria. Serious problems that, but and also serious problems the day before of bombing an Islamic State leader as he was praying in a mosque. When you say that the Islamic State's not Islamic. But you know, the other side of the aisle is no better. This article reads, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, now he would be a Republican, he made the case Monday for a more active U.S. military presence overseas, including a larger U.S. military. And he defended the government's intelligence collecting efforts in a speech laying out his foreign policy platform. I don't think I could find three things that I were more opposed to than that. Scott, are you liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat? None of the above? How would you respond to that?
None of the above. I don't care. I don't care.
So if your alternative to Hillary Clinton this fall, who is the Muslim-supporting queen, is Chris Christie. Or, you know, Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham says, you know, I want to go after them and them there Islamic staters. You know, he wants to go to war against them. Who are you going to vote for? Or none of the above?
I'm not going to vote. I haven't voted. I didn't vote last election.
So. Yeah. Glenn, if you're still listening, I know you're still on the line. I don't know if you're still available, but how would you respond to the option between someone like a Lindsey Graham or a Chris Christie, more military, more U.S. intervention, more U.S. spying, vis-a-vis... running against someone like Clinton, who has consistently lied about the influence of Islam?
Well, I don't think either one is a realistic option or a truthful option. I mean, all we have is sociopathic liars playing manipulation games. So the only thing, if you're outside that system, then using words, as you said, to try and persuade people. Along the way, it would also be nice not to persuade Israel not to have Mossad collaborating with the Saudis. I mean,
that's pretty wild.
That's pretty short-sighted behavior.
Right. Yeah, I would agree. You know, and Glenn, I don't want to get the misimpression too that I am opposed to a violent response when appropriate. I am. You know, the program, we try to get out of and never step in the kiddie pool of minor issues. And so I even tackled the Waco disaster, not from a point of view of the stupidity of the police response to the whole thing, but in the bigger scope of things that are affecting the nation. And in the bigger scope of things, violence is almost never an appropriate response, and it's never an appropriate response if you are an individual citizen. So there is no way to engage or to promote violence that would be appropriate as part of what we do here, and so I don't. But I understand that if, for example, if I were seeing a woman abused and I could do something about it and I was empowered to do something about it, and if it required me to engage in a violent manner to keep a woman from harm, and I was able to say, you know, there's a reasonable chance that I might get hurt or killed, but there's a better chance that I could prevail and protecting this woman, I would engage in a violent way to protect a woman, even with risk to myself. I would do the same thing you're doing. And the guy that was in Egypt, the story we were reading about how he tried to use words to protect a woman that was being abused, and then he became the victim of abuse.
Right. That's why the Second Amendment is so prescient. They, just to change the context real quickly as a hypothetical, if I were on the street And I was just happened to be an innocent bystander. I saw police take into custody a non-resisting, non-violent person, handcuff him, and then proceed to bludgeon him to death. And such things have happened. Mm-hmm. We have the Second Amendment, and we have the option of performing a, you know, citizen's arrest. And, you know, it is, if a police person wearing a badge begins to behave criminally and murderously, we as citizens have the authority and the ability to respond to that. Now, it's a risky business, and you hope that everybody survives and it gets hammered out in court, right. You know. But,
chances of prevailing are one in a million.
And so what do I say? I have a faced with a choice of watching the person be bludgeoned to death and holding my tongue and going quietly later to the family's lawyer and maybe, you know, becoming a witness later on in an attempt to effect something more routine to justice and mercy. Those would be the choices in the heat of the moment.
Put it on a larger scale. I just read to you what independent investigators said was now rampant, pervasive in Egypt. If you just turn and walk away and you pretend like you have not heard this information, or if you've listened to it but are unmoved by it and don't say we need to do something to protect those men and women, we as a country need to expose and condemn this at the very least and to stop arming it and funding it at the very least. If you do either of those two things and you don't act, it's really no different than seeing the individual act on the street and turning and walking away.
Right, exactly. So, and this is why they need the sheeple. This is why they need, the people to be
people conditioned. So they're no longer moral. So they're no longer judgmental. So they're no longer capable of responding courageously. Correct.
Compassion is
really equated with cowardice.
Right. Well, that guy is the guy who shot the students at Virginia Tech, a room full of young, physically fit, able people. If they had mobbed that guy, if one person had the courage, and then two more had the courage to follow, if 30 25-pound backpacks filled with textbooks came flying at him, and benches and chairs, and then somebody jumped him.
Or in Fort Hood, when Hassan started screaming Allahu Akbar and picking off one person after another, and there wasn't anybody in the military that could do anything. It was an off-duty policeman. That finally took him down.
Right. It's just amazing. I've seen jokes made on TV about these in retail stores. If there's a shoplifter and they catch him, they have the thing where they go, swarm, swarm, and the employees are supposed to surround the person, you know, to intimidate them with numbers. But, I mean, there's something, that, as much as that made a good comedy skit, there's something to be said for. You know, it's almost like an ant when those ants outnumber us 100 to 1, and if they ever figure that out, it's the end of our way of life. Mm. And, you know, if with 30 Virginia Tech students pelt the guy, if 20 people on the street, there was just a woman who thwarted the police were just, back down from arresting someone the other day by people on the street who intervened.
Right. Yeah. You know, I've received thousands of death threats for my willingness to do the courageous and the compassionate, the moral, the enlightened thing, which is to expose and condemn the immorality, the depravity, the violent and deadly and destructive nature of Islam. Now, it took courage to do that, and yet everyone that would assail me will do so out of complete ignorance, and they will advocate a religion that is perpetrating these hateful and harmful behaviors. It takes courage to stand up and expose and condemn that which is evil.
Now, if you look at
if you listen to Dode's 119 David's 119th Psalm, he constantly talks about the consequence of his committed and consistent willingness to stand up to hate, to despise, to expose and condemn those things which are evil. And it takes courage. And very few people today have the willingness, the good sense to do it.
And that's in the context of day-to-day operations. Being in the media or when life is going, but as opposed to the context or the paradigm of being a situation where a barbaric crime is being committed right in front of your face. There's two different contexts, but both involve courage and clear, careful thought and choice making.
Yeah, you know, I was been mugged three times. The last time that I was mugged was I was in a McDonald's directly a parking lot of McDonald's directly across the street from the dispatch office for the LAPD, Los Angeles Police Department, substation right across the street. And I'm in the parking lot looking at the windows of the police department. A guy walks up and he's got his hand down his pants and he says, you know what this is? And, you know, I didn't want to be vulgar at the time. I was standing.
I would not have restrained myself.
Yeah. And, I'm standing by two Olympic athletes. A discus thrower and a pole vaulter. I mean, these guys are strong. They're big. They're my fraternity brothers. And this guy walks up to me and demands my wallet. Now, I'm bigger than he is, and at the time I was stronger than he was. I'm not stronger than the gun that he had down his pants, but I am certainly bigger and stronger.
Yeah.
And the two guys that I'm with, between the three of us, I mean, there is no way that guy had my two buddies responded as I did. This guy would never have had the chance to mug us. But they didn't.
Did you ever figure out if he actually had a gun or if he was bluffing?
Yes, because when I continued to lecture him about this choice of life behaviors, I was trying to buy time, I was across from the police station. This guy, choice of life behaviors was going to lead to a destructive tendency in his life and that he should really reconsider how he engaged with other people. He pulled his hand out from his pants and put a revolver between my eyes and said, "Listen, blankety blank, if you don't give me your blankety blank wallet, I'm going to blow your blankety blank head off."
Right. Yeah, I think there's a distinct chance that, you know, it depends on how you want to talk. I mean, if somebody had the gun in his pants, right, that's about the moment when he's sort of incapacitated. If he can close,
yes, that's right.
You know, you take a risk of getting shot. And if you have a shot, maybe not killed, but if I were to get it, I would make him hurt so bad.
Yeah. So it's a situation where we have just been conditioned to respond very differently. We've been conditioned to respond passively to evil.
Right.
So that those who are indoctrinated in America's educational institutions, when they hear that Islam has perpetrated between 100 and 200 million sexual mutilations, when 90% of Muslim women have been sexually abused, and where the woman is now afraid that her own husband and son are going to kill her for being abused, pay no attention. No blame. The nature of our response and the calculus as to whether or not we engage with more than words to expose and condemn evil is often a factor not just of what is the calculus of the probability of success versus grave danger. There is a set of circumstances which changes that calculus so that you don't much care. And that is if one of my sons, or if I had a daughter, but let's just use sons. If one of my sons was being attacked and abused by someone, I would not hesitate to calculate the odds of interfering. The odds could be 100% against losing and having both of us pummeled as opposed to just one of us pummeled. Wouldn't matter. I wouldn't use words. I would engage immediately, and I would engage with all of the force that I could muster, including deadly force, if someone was harming one of my children in a substantial material way. Or my wife would do the same thing. So the reason I want to say that is that we, as humans, know how to protect those we love. Now, this is not true in Islam. Islam is so corrosive that the husband, the father, and the son of the woman that was so brutally raped that she was paralyzed through the incident now is afraid of her own son, husband, and father. Because she knows that they're duty-bound as Muslims to kill her. But if you have any degree of a functioning conscience, a nazama, to use Yahweh's parlance, then you are going to respond to protect those you love. And the reason I say this is that your situation where you talked about what you would do, where words are inadequate, and I was describing the rape of that young woman in the first hour, and you correctly said that sometimes words are just inadequate. Well, I agree with you. Sometimes words are inadequate even for God. When God found that that men were being excessively violent during the time of Noah, and Noah and his family were part of God's family, what did God do to protect Noah and his family?
A set of blueprints.
Yeah, for the ark. But he didn't just send him a set of blueprints for the ark. He saw to it that those who were the hosts of evil, those who were perpetrating this violence on their fellow man, were killed, didn't they?
Oh yeah, and during the time of preparation when Noah was building the ark, they were inclined to mock him, but nobody actually physically attempted to stop him. Apparently,
right? Yeah,
and I think Noah had something to do with that.
Yeah, when Israel is threatened in the Magog War, is there going to be a violent response when the Muslims are on the precipice of taking over Jerusalem and of conquering and destroying the Promised Land? Is there going to be a violent response that's going to be either perpetrated by God himself or at least aided by God?
Right. Yeah, when, absolutely. Five-sixths of the invading army.
Yeah. When just before Yahweh returns and Yehuda and Yisrael finally accept the terms of the covenant, finally look up to Yahweh, call him by name, accept the terms and conditions of the covenant, are reconciled into that relationship, and now the world's largest army is poised to annihilate them. Is God going to intervene peaceably or violently to protect his children?
Violently, yeah.
That's, yeah. So, you know, as a father to his children, we'll use violence to protect his children. There is a time when words alone are insufficient. If God were to simply say, you know, what I think I'm going to do with that group of people that want to rape and plunder and terrorize my children is I'm going to speak to them. I'm going to use my words to dissuade them. What chance would that have of prevailing?
Not too much, you know.
Yeah, and if God were to say, you know, I'm going to look the other way, and I'm going to start the millennium, and I'm going to allow these people that came to rape and to plunder and to destroy and to murder my children, I'm going to allow them into the millennial Shabbat. What are the chances are that that would be like the conditions found at Eden, or would it just be the same hell that preceded it?
Right, it would be just another version of the hell.
Yeah. So sometimes you're right. Words are inadequate. Sometimes words are inadequate. Now, it doesn't change the fact that for what we are called to do, what we're encouraged to do, what we do on this program and is the appropriate thing. Let's expose. Let's condemn. Let's advocate isolation, but not violence. Perhaps we don't need hypotheticals as it relates to what God would do, what God has done. I talked about the calculus that is forgotten. If it is a family member that is being abused, and the fact that if it is a family member, my wife, my sons, for those that have daughters, if I had a daughter, I have a daughter-in-law now. If it were a member of my family, and they were being physically abused by someone, I would intervene physically. I would get between my family and the perpetrators. And I would try to hold the perpetrators off no matter how much violence was required to do so. And in most circumstances, since I'm almost always unarmed, the likelihood is, and also because most perpetrators, particularly those that are institutional perpetrators, act as gangs. So the Gang of Islam is 1.5 billion people. But they operate in gangs. And when they operate in gangs, they are prone to violence. They're perpetrating violence on a family member here. The likelihood of failing to achieve the desired result and of suffering great physical harm in the process, being beaten to a pulp, maybe even killed physically. They can't kill my soul, but they could certainly kill me physically, is very high. So I would say, what would God do in that situation? And we know. When he occupied a set-apart spirit in a diminished form, occupied a physical body for his children to fulfill the promises associated with the covenant, he allowed us, humanity, the gang of man, to beat him to a pulp, to rip the skin off his flesh, to nail him to an upright pole, to torture him. And that was the easy part. The hard part was he allowed demons then to have access to his soul to torture him in Sheol. He was willing to do that. Now, with God, it's different than you and me. I'm going to respond emotionally when I have a family member that's threatened, and I would rather be physically harmed than to stand by idly, knowing, even though I know that I can't accomplish the goal of protecting my child, but I'd still rather die and be harmed in the process of trying to save them than just standing by idly.
And he also challenged us even further. He said, if you love only your own, you know, even the publicans and the sinners do the same. You know, he's entreating us to love certainly to love our families, but also to love those who are not. And also his suffering, his sacrifice, Yahweh loves, protects, and was willing to suffer for his own. Whereas those who serve Hillel ben Shakar are inevitably betrayed by him. The Night of Long Knives eventually comes.
Yeah.
And his very minions are betrayed and backstabbed by him. So who do you want to serve, the one who is faithful unto death or the one who will inevitably betray you?
Yeah, you know, and I was trying to understand his perspective as it relates to whom he was, whom he took the strikes for. And, of course, you could isolate and say, you know, he only took those blows on behalf of his children, but that's really not true, because 100% of those for whom he accepted their penalty and took those blows were not his children when he took them.
Right.
He took them so that they could become his children, and so he did it for those who were not his own, so that they could become his own.
At the time, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
This is one of those classic Calvinist versus Arminian doctrinal arguments, right, where why would God waste his subjecting to suffering for those who wouldn't turn? And, you know, there's certainly, and it's like certainly Yahweh knows what he's doing. And, no, he didn't waste any suffering
or
he wouldn't miss anyone. Yeah, I'm sure everything was titrated perfectly, as it should be.
Yeah, his was a calculus. You know, he's the creator of the universe. Everything is calculated. He has emotional responses. That's why he says he's jealous for his children. But this was a calculus. He made the determination that he would do this for those who were not his own so that they could become members of his family. He really established the right code of conduct in this case. You're right. We should engage. There are times where we should engage and damn the torpedoes, damn the blows.
And he knew the thing is he had several advantages over our perspective. Number one, he's perfectly righteous and just,
right.
And he has the added advantage of knowing what's going to go on.
And he knew that he would ultimately prevail, you know, and I knew that I would ultimately fail in my case, but it's because of my inadequacies. He's not inadequate. I mean, I understand it's a different calculus.
I don't know. You never know what you can do with the jawbone of an ass. Things can be quite surprising when Yahweh's on your side.
Yeah, it's true.
You know,
with a single rock and a sling. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's exactly the case. And that's one of the reasons that with words on this program and in the books, prophetofdoom.org and yadayah.com and introtogod.org, even questioningpaul.com. Well, I'm willing to state these things so bluntly is that Yah was in the business of protecting his children. I don't, you know, if he's in the business of protecting his children, nothing matters.
You know, I suspect I may still have something more of an activist pneumatology relative to the Ruach Kodesh thing or something, because I was spared from an armed robbery at a laundromat a number of years ago. That was so statistically improbable that I sort of, you know, it's my belief that the Yahweh through his Ruach was involved in that situation.
Yeah, I've been spared. My life has been spared.
The airplane incident.
The first was when I was scheduled on a flight, which was the first act of Islamic terrorism. Abu Nidal brought down an airline bomb that I had a ticket to be aboard. 77 people died on that aircraft, but I wasn't on it because I had malaria at the time, and they wouldn't allow me to board it. And so I know what it's like to be, what are the odds? I know what the odds are when I was upside down over the Pentagon because of wake vortex with the two Airbuses. And the plane that I was in cannot come out of that circumstance. It's impossible. And so in that circumstance, there is no way to resolve the problem as a pilot. And yet here I am. And there's a number of occasions where I was in improbable situations, and all of them were before I was part of Yahweh's family. So you're back in the position to say, all right, Yahweh will protect those who are not his own so that they can become his own.
Right. Right.
You know, when I had the guns that were pulled to my head when not during the mugging, I ultimately gave the man a $20 bill. But when I had guns were pulled to my head, when I was down in the dungeon in the West Bank by Muslims who were ever ready and willing to kill me, and I survived that incident. At the time, I wasn't part of Yahweh's family. But I do think that Yahweh does protect those who will become his children because he knows in advance. So before you knew him, he absolutely could have chosen to, and probably did, protect you. And I know that Yahweh has communicated with me again before I knew him. He did so with Abraham, right? Did so with Moshe. So why would he be any different with you and me?
I can just hear John Calvin and Jacobus Arminius arguing about limited atonement and unconditional election and foreknowledge and predestination and all that sort of thing.
Foreknowledge and predestination are very different things. That's the beauty of coming to understand the relative nature of time and the fact that if you are light, time simply is. You're not in a timeless environment. You're in a time where a situation where all time is available to you at any time. And so as light, Yahweh would know our future. And so he is not precluding or somehow manipulating our choices by interacting with us prior to the time that we choose him. Because, for example, with Moshe, he knew that Moshe would be reluctant initially, but he knew that he would talk to Moshe and that Moshe would say, yeah, you know, I'll do this. I want to engage the way that you have asked. And Moshe made the choice of his own volition. It's just that Yahweh knew that he would do so before he did.
Yeah, and yet we know that the Ruach of Yahweh will not strive forever with
that's correct. So
that, which implies, it tells us that he does, you know, he does by his spirit strive with the souls.
Moshe again. Moshe put together his argument, and it was essentially, my sense is that he didn't want to go because he knew he was held on a murder charge, and therefore be assassinated the moment that he arrived in Egypt. He used the fact that he was not an eloquent speaker as the excuse. And Yahweh listened to him and said, all right, I'll make an accommodation for that. I'm going to have someone speak for you that that is named Enlightened Free Will, because, you know, that tickles my fancy anyway. So Yahweh is, but had Moshe said, okay, now I have another objection, and my next objection is this. You know, after a while, Yahweh says, you know, I'm just not going to continue if all it's going to do is lead to another objection.
Is that why when I pull the string on my Moshe live action figure, the audio is indistinct?
Yeah, that's reason. That's the reason. look at Abraham. Abraham, we don't get any feedback from Abraham that he was unwilling, except for the fact that he didn't completely comply with the first request. Walk away from your country. Walk away from your father's home. He took his father with him, didn't he? But only a certain way. Only to Haran. And when Moshe says, listen, God, I understand if you keep on offering me this inheritance thing, but frankly, I don't get it. You know, what am I inheriting? I don't have a kid. And Yahweh didn't give up on him. He said, okay, let me show you what you're inheriting. And he took him to the light and to the spiritual realm of heaven. And he said, oh, now I get it. And so after he was exposed to it, Yahweh says, I'm going to count that as vindication on behalf of Abraham. It is always interesting when you think of what the options are and how Yahweh is going to respond to our various choices, what he's willing to do on our behalf. But I'm going to give you a scenario here so we can deal with this predestination. I have a country, it's called My Land. I'm the Grand Poobah of My Land. You are my lead scout. And My Land, and it's adjacent and separated by a river from not My Land, but there is a bridge over the wide river from not My Land into My Land. But we're down there in a valley, and we can't see it. But I can send you up to the top of a hill, and you can look to see if the army is crossing the river from not My Land into My Land along this bridge. And I send you up to the top of that hill, and you witness the army crossing the bridge, and you come down to me, and you said, yep, we have a problem. The army is crossing the bridge. You are a witness of what the army has done. You're telling me that the army has crossed the bridge and that we now have an army in our land. Did you do anything to encourage them to change their decision, to alter their decision to come into our land by witnessing them having done so?
Nope, I just observed.
Yep. Now, change the high ground that you were on as the scout to moving you to a higher ground, which is the nature of energy, and you now get to witness it in the future. You get to see what they're going to do before they do it. Are you influencing them or just simply serving as a witness and reporting on what they've done? Yeah, so just a different perspective. Yeah.
This land is my land from California to Virginia, homeland.
Well, that really explains the difference. Yahweh is a participant in our future, and he tells us what he's going to do, but he's not a manipulator of our future. He just says, you know, if you do these things, this is how I'm going to respond, but if you do those things, this will be the consequence.
But so while we're doing this, we could also delve into, of course, that issue gets complex with allegations of passivity being tantamount to activity and all that stuff. And mm-hmm. We can also consider how many Malachi can sit on the head of a pin.
Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of passivity, if Yahweh had approached me when I was an ordained ruling elder, when I was an active evangelist, trained as an evangelist, going to people's homes as an evangelist, when I was leading Bible studies, if he had approached me at that time, I would have been highly reluctant. And it's likely that his frustration in trying to introduce himself to me, he would have grown weary. If he approached me at the time that I was just beginning to be disgusted with Christianity and walking away from it, I might not have been open-minded, particularly since I was so, my time was so preoccupied with a young family and with business that it may have been difficult. Just as if Yahweh had reached out to Moshe when he was engaged in the affairs of Pharaoh and living in his house.
Right.
But Yahweh picked a time to engage with me that I was absolutely able and willing to focus on what he was saying. And when I was open to his invitation, and where my objections were minimal. And so the timing that he picked to say hello had a huge influence as to whether or not I was going to respond. So I'm right. personally glad that he was passive when he was passive, and that he introduced himself when he did. Had he not chosen that time, it would have been a different circumstance.
Right, and so this is why, like, when we look at others who aren't where we are, you know, I always try to take the benefit for the emergent
yeah.
favor of Yahweh,
right.
though I, and I'm
right.
very averse to contemptuousness, so try not to hold in contempt, but, man, except when they're, you know, for example, I don't hold the merely ignorant in contempt, I hold the tenaciously, willfully ignorant in great contempt.
Great. In fact, when I wrote Prophet of Doom, I said that Muslims were the prominent victims of Islam. And as those who are just ignorant and have been played for fools, even the victims of Christianity, those who have been led astray, I feel great compassion for. Those who are leading astray, those who are advocating on behalf of either religion or advocating on behalf of, like Christie did, we need more American intervention, more American military, and more American spying. Then you go from saying, I have compassion for you because at one time I was similarly misled, to now you are the problem.
Right.
You are using your position to advocate things that are horribly wrong.
We can't stand the souls of humans forever.
Yeah, so there is a distinct separation by how I'm going to respond to family, to those who have been deceived, and those who are doing the deceiving, discriminating.